All right, everybody, welcome back to the Invisible College. That was Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, which I introduce in order to get in for the first time, really, to the topic of romanticism. But first, I'm your host, John Pastelli. This is the Invisible College, your one-stop shop. I'm trying to do the DJ thing. Welcome back, everybody. Do they still have DJs? No, they have YouTubers and podcasters and what have you. Welcome back to the Invisible College and to our course on modern British literature from romanticism to modernism. As I was saying last week, in our discussion of William Blake, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is whether and how to generalize, because one of the things that happens when you teach literature courses to undergraduates is you'd often do begin with certain kinds of generalizations. You'll start talking about romanticism with a bullet-pointed list of the characterizations of romanticism in art and literature. And I have such lists and have made such lists. But then, once you start reading various texts and authors, it inevitably comes up the way in which this and such author is who is gathered under the heading of romanticism or modernism or realism or postmodernism or whatever you want, whatever movement you're talking about, doesn't fit the criteria or fits some of them and not others, because of course, great literature and great writers have a kind of irreducible individuality. That's part of what the definition of greatness is. If you just followed a list of bullet-pointed characteristics, you wouldn't actually produce a memorable or striking work. And so beginning with this kind of a list of generalizations often seems counterproductive or misleading about art and culture and how it works and what it is. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, human beings do generalize and categorize and need to make categories in order to organize our knowledge and our experience. And so you can go too far in the anarchic direction of everything being absolutely itself and incapable of being subsumed under a category, just as you can go too far in the direction of making rigid lists and categories and letting the categories do your thinking for you. So I'm trying to avoid these two dangers. Now, with William Blake, the danger sort of avoids itself because he becomes retrospectively folded into the romantic movement that he wasn't really a part of on two different grounds, one of which being that he belonged to the kind of the generation that came before it, the category, the more obscure category of the Age of Sensibility, the pre-romantic or proto-romantic culture of the late 18th century. And then for the second reason, that he was kind of not entirely unknown, but mostly unknown in his own life. I think some of the romantics, like Wordsworth and Coleridge, had maybe read a few things by him, but he wasn't really recovered until later. And so I describe this kind of trans-temporality of Blake, where he's both before romanticism and then because he's only really recovered later and really only beginning to be comprehended with modernism, he kind of is both pre-romantic and post-romantic. He's Age of Sensibility and he's a modernist. And so it didn't even really make sense to talk about him in terms of romanticism. But today we're turning our attention to William Wordsworth, and next week to Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And these two men, particularly in what influencers would call their iconic collab known as the Lyrical Ballads, really did kind of themselves incept the romantic movement as we later understand it. Now, that probably sounds like the great man theory of history and culture, and it is. I mean, I'm more or less subscribed to that on balance, you know, considering the alternatives. But I will get in a second, I will get into the problems and the questions around that way of thinking about cultural history. So I am going to begin today by talking about romanticism. I'm not going to give you a bullet-pointed list of its characteristics, All I'm going to say now, really, and this might be all I say by way of a generalization into Romanticism, is that it tends to be a mode of literature and art that privileges imagination, subjectivity, and feeling over rationality, objectivity, and thinking. I think even that's a little much. Even that is a little misleading because it might suggest that some of the, for instance, the poetry that will be less formally accomplished and crafted than in fact it is. But I think that will do. Other things, you know, something about nature often tends to be added to that definition. But I think nature... I'll get into this with Wordsworth. I think Romanticism is not where the customary thing to say is as a love of nature and appreciation of nature, a turn to nature away from the artifice of society as represented by Enlightenment philosophy and neoclassical poetry and painting. And that's fine as far as it goes, but I think Blake is not alone in finding nature problematic. I think Romanticism makes nature newly problematic in a secular society that no longer quite has Christian assumptions about what nature is. It's kind of how I'd think of it, not so much love of nature. Even Wordsworth doesn't quite love nature, as you're going to see. They don't all come to hate it in the way Blake does, but that's more surprisingly common than you might think. So I would say concern for nature, concern about nature, but love of nature is a little much. So we'll talk about that. But that's as far as I'm going to go with a generalization. It's a movement about the shaping power of the imagination, and it tends to stress that over the power of reason and rationality that had been celebrated in the Enlightenment. And so that's all I'd say by way of a generalization. So I'm going to fire up this here slideshow that I'll make available to you on grandhotelabyss.substack.com, which is the kind of, you might be listening to this on iTunes or some other platform, but that's kind of the home base of the Invisible College. That's the Invisible Student Union. Now I can't belabor the metaphor so much, but in any case, that's where you'll find the PDF of the slideshow, grandhotelabyss.substack.com. And I have this slideshow on Wordsworth. I've called it Trailing Clouds of Glory, which is a line from the poem of Wordsworth that most makes you see the way in which nature for him is as much a problem as it is a resource of imagination or an object of love. If you ever do listen to this slideshow, no, watch this slideshow. So I'm experiencing synesthesia, a classic characteristic of the genius. But if you ever look at this slideshow alongside listening to this podcast/lecture, you'll see that I've put on the first slide a painting, which is of an area in Wordsworth's beloved Lake District, where he grew up, and the area it's not so much that he put the Lake District on the map of England as a tourist site and a heritage site. That was actually happening in his childhood. He sort of came into that a little later, and we'll talk about why momentarily. But he did this sort of canonical literary expression of the description of this place, the Lake District, which is an area in northwestern England that offers scenery and landscapes that were attractive to the proto-romantic and romantic imagination for reasons we will discuss shortly. And the painting, if you ever do look at this, is by Thomas Gainsborough, who is one of those late 18th century British sort of establishment painters that Blake hated. And I thought, you know, I'd do some equal justice, some fair and balanced both sides coverage here by showing you a Gainsborough painting. It's quite beautiful, but you can